Chapter 17, Balancing Your Formal Evaluation Responsibilities. As you develop the habit of visiting classrooms daily, you'll realize that you're collecting far more information about teacher practice than most principals have at their disposal. Because you're in classrooms so frequently, you'll be able to write much better final evaluations based on far more evidence. Though our focus in the high-performance instructional leadership model is not primarily on evaluation, the evidence you collect and discuss with teachers is immensely useful when writing formal evaluations. In this chapter, we'll explore the delicate relationship between your informal classroom visits and your evaluative responsibilities as a school administrator. We'll discuss how every aspect of your teacher's teaching should be considered fair game, recall contractual restrictions on informal observations, differentiate between high-stakes and low-stakes evaluations, and learn to allocate formal evaluation time with the 80-20 rule. We'll also delve into how to close the gap between high-stakes and low-stakes teachers and learn the claim, evidence, interpretation, and judgment, CEIJ, method for writing rock-solid evaluations. If you're not formally in an evaluative role, this chapter will help you distinguish your visits from evaluative visits and protect the purpose of your work with teachers. Consider everything fair game. As teachers, we learn to loathe hearing the question, "Will this be on the test?" from our students. We want students to internalize the idea that everything is fair game when it comes to their learning. Similarly, we want our teachers to be on all the time, not just putting on a good show for their formal observations, Marshall 2013. Our students need teachers to be operating at 100% every day, not just once or twice a year. You may prefer to mentally draw a distinction between instructional leadership activities that support growth, such as informal visits and conversations, and those that are part of the official evaluation process, such as prearranged formal observations. Certainly, if you're an instructional coach or in another role which does not involve evaluating teachers, it's essential to create a clear boundary around your coaching work, so teachers know you will not report on their challenges and weaknesses to their evaluator. This is a basic requirement of coaching that you should respect as the foundation of your professional relationship. But if you're a teacher's evaluator, the separation between support and evaluation exists only in your mind. Legally and ethically, you cannot draw a strict distinction between information you'll use for supporting teachers' growth and information you'll use for conducting their formal evaluations. As I've emphasized throughout this book, the chief benefit of visiting classrooms daily is acquiring decisional information. It's inevitable that you will use some of this information, directly or indirectly, to make evaluation decisions. For this reason, it's essential to avoid the claim, at any point in the process, that your visits to classrooms are non-evaluative. As an evaluator, every interaction you have with teachers informs your appraisal of their practice, and ultimately, your official evaluation of their performance. We now explore how to handle evaluation evidence for underperforming teachers. If we proceed with due caution in these situations, we'll be more than prepared for the rest of our evaluations. Remember contractual restrictions on informal observations. Depending on your teacher contract, it may or may not be officially permissible to use informal observations in official teacher evaluations. For example, collective bargaining agreements may stipulate that only formal classroom observations can be used as evidence in a formal evaluation. If you're in a similar situation, don't despair. If we understand why these restrictions are often in place, we can find appropriate ways to work within them. The main purpose of distinguishing between formal and informal observations is to prevent gotcha observations in which supervisors lack the appropriate context to understand what they're seeing. You'll recall from Chapter 13, page 120, that individual lessons aren't the appropriate grain size or unit of analysis for teacher evaluations. Yet, traditionally, evaluators only observe most teachers once or twice a year. Without a chance to brief the observer on the context and purpose of the lesson, teachers may understandably fear that evaluators will misjudge their efforts. If you aren't able to use evidence from informal visits to classrooms, check your teacher contract and district policies carefully. It may be that you can conduct unannounced formal observations, which probably are not too dissimilar from the visits you're already making. You may have to stay a certain minimum amount of time, or provide a written report, or have an official post-observation conference with the teacher within 48 hours, for example. If a small adjustment to your process for visiting classrooms can enable these visits to count in the final evaluation, it may be more than worth the extra effort. For an ambitious model that replaces all formal observations with unscheduled mini-observations, see Kim Marshall's 2013 excellent book, Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation. See also Mini-Observations, page 26. Another approach that may work, again, depending on the specifics of your teacher contract, is to document your visits not through formal observation reports, but through letters of concern or reprimand when you encounter misconduct issues. There should be some provision for this in your school's policies. For example, if you saw a teacher behaving inappropriately toward a student in the hallway, the policy would not prevent you from addressing this situation as a supervisor simply because it wasn't part of a scheduled formal observation. If the policy specifically prohibits using evidence from your unscheduled classroom visits, addressing misconduct may be an effective approach with extremely low-performing teachers. Our focus in this book is on teacher practice rather than misconduct, but when their practice is extremely poor, teachers are much more likely to resort to approaches that fall within the scope of misconduct, such as yelling at students while struggling with classroom management. If you have any concerns about teacher underperformance, don't delay in speaking with your supervisor, human resources representative, or legal counsel. It's essential to begin with a clear understanding of the contractual or legal restrictions on using evidence from your informal visits in formal evaluations. Even under the strictest limitations, informal visits to classrooms can help you make informed decisions about where to spend more of your time during the formal observation process. If you can't use any evidence from informal visits in formal evaluations, simply schedule additional formal observations whenever you discover that you need more evidence about a particular teacher's practice. Differentiate high stakes and low stakes. As you gather more and more information from your informal visits, whether you can use this information in official evaluations or not, you'll gain clarity on which teachers are doing well and which are doing poorly. This information can help you classify each teacher evaluation as either low stakes or high stakes. You'll likely have many low-stakes teachers who will not be at any risk of a negative evaluation due to a strong track record of consistent performance. You'll have a smaller number of teachers who are marginal and a few who are missing the mark by a large margin. These struggling teachers, as well as new teachers whom you do not yet know very well, will be in the high-stakes category. It might seem that the fairest approach would be to defer all judgment until the end of the year, so you'll have an equal amount of evidence for each teacher, and so you can judge each teacher impartially according to this evidence. In reality, though, you'll have a strong sense of how each teacher is doing long before the end of the year. And even if you can defer formally rating your teachers, it's impossible and unwise to defer all judgment. Putting off judgments about teacher performance until the end of the year is intellectually dishonest, wasteful, and ineffective. It also results in a great deal of unnecessary documentation for high-performing teachers and results in an inadequate amount of evidence for low-performing teachers. Instead, I recommend a more focused approach. As a result of your frequent classroom visits, you'll have a strong intuitive sense about each teacher's level of performance, as well as a great deal of written documentation. It's unlikely that you'll miss warning signs about the teachers you deem low stakes, because you'll continue to visit their classrooms regularly and engage them in ongoing conversations about practice. The more you know about teachers' thinking and decision-making, and the more frequently you've seen their teaching, the clearer a sense you'll have of their true level of performance. And because you're evaluating teachers' overall practice rather than individual lessons, it will only strengthen your relationships with and impact on lower-performing teachers to have them on your high-stakes list. What does it mean for an evaluation to be high stakes? It means you must adequately prepare for the possibility that the teacher may not meet expectations and may thus need to receive an unsatisfactory evaluation. This demands a more intense level of evidence collection and effort, and requires that you take all feasible steps to address any poor teaching you've seen. Too often, evaluators vastly underestimate the amount of work it takes to respond to ineffective teaching, and since there's a high degree of uncertainty involved, we often devote this effort to the wrong teachers. To err on the side of safety, mentally categorize roughly 20% of teachers, marginal performers, as well as new teachers who haven't yet established themselves, as having high-stakes evaluations. This categorization exists in your mind only. You shouldn't communicate it to the teacher in any way. After all, it's only a preparatory step, so you can focus your evaluation efforts where they're likely to have the most impact. In most cases, you'll see enough improvement or evidence of satisfactory practice that you won't actually pursue dismissal for these teachers. The remaining 80% of your teachers can be safely deemed low stakes, This 80-20 ratio seems to be the sweet spot, balancing effort and uncertainty. If you were to treat only 5% of your evaluations as high stakes, you might fail to identify several struggling teachers and fail to collect adequate evidence about their practice. On the other hand, a 50-50 ratio would lead to an untenable amount of wasted effort. Low-stakes evaluations should and must consume less of your time and effort. If you categorize 80% of your evaluations as low-stakes and 20% as high-stakes, and if you visit classrooms daily, as I advocate throughout this book, you'll stand a very high chance of gathering all of the evidence you need without too much wasted effort. In contrast to this approach, most evaluators focus on only the teachers they consider the absolute worst, typically one or two per year. This often leads to shock and frustration when other teachers, who may have been promising new hires or may have flown beneath the radar for years, emerge late in the school year as the biggest concerns. Again, teachers shouldn't experience any negative consequences from your closer scrutiny because it's merely a categorization in your mind. There's no harm in being prepared. Allocate formal evaluation time with the 80-20 rule. Once you've categorized your teachers as high or low stakes, how should you allocate your instructional leadership time and effort? In implementing the high-performance instructional leadership model we've discussed in this book, you'll want to spend roughly equal time on informal visits with each staff member, both to ensure that you gain a good balance of information and to maintain the perception of fairness. When you start visiting classrooms more frequently, some teachers may feel that you're targeting them, so it's essential to demonstrate that you're spending roughly equal time in each classroom. You should more purposefully target your formal evaluation efforts, though, to ensure that the process achieves results that justify the effort. And this means investing dramatically more time and effort in writing your high-stakes evaluations. Compared to informal classroom visits, formal evaluation activities should only take up a small proportion of your overall instructional leadership time, and it's essential to allocate this time overwhelmingly to the teachers who are most at risk of receiving a negative evaluation. Plan to spend 80% of your formal evaluation time on high-stakes evaluations, and the remaining 20% on the low-stakes evaluations. You'll likely observe each teacher for the same required amount of time, for example, 30 or 60 minutes, depending on norms and policies in your district, so the difference is mostly in your behind-the-scenes effort. This may seem extreme. If you have 20 teachers and plan to spend 100 hours per year evaluating them, following the 80-20 rule means spending 80 hours on your four high-stakes evaluations, 20 hours per teacher, and only 20 hours on your 16 low-stakes evaluations, an hour and 15 minutes per teacher. Consider the alternative, though. When we fail to effectively evaluate our lowest-performing teachers, we have to repeat the process the following year, and in the meantime, students suffer. 20 hours is a reasonable estimate of how much time it takes to conduct a high-quality, high-stakes evaluation, though it may require more time to carry out additional steps, such as probation and dismissal. And ideally, those 20 hours result in dramatic improvements that forever change the teacher's career, so you're not wasting this time, even if the final evaluation is positive. How can you use this differentiated allocation of time effectively? Throughout most of the year, there will be little difference in how you approach high-stakes and low-stakes teachers' evaluations. If you normally observe for an hour when completing formal observations, observe both your high- and low-stakes teachers for an hour. Teachers should not notice a difference. But you'll want to invest dramatically more time and effort in assembling and writing about your evidence. Take extra care to avoid making statements that aren't supported by your evidence, especially encouraging remarks such as, "keep up the good work," that may be interpreted later as indicating a lack of performance problems. As you obtain more information, you can differentiate your approach further. If a new teacher you've placed in the high-stakes group turns out to be outstanding, you can mentally recategorize her as your confidence grows and spend less time on documentation and writing. On the other hand, if your concerns about struggling teachers grow as you spend more time in classrooms, you can increase the time and effort you put into documentation and initiate other support and evaluation activities, such as plans of improvement, as needed. Be sure to consult with your supervisor, human resources contact, or legal counsel for any teachers you believe may need to be placed in a path toward dismissal. Most of the extra effort you invest in high-stakes teacher evaluations will come at the end of the year, unless your concerns are serious enough to justify earlier action. Close the high-stakes evidence gap. As you approach the end of the year, it's essential to review your evidence for each high-stakes evaluation and ensure that you have enough evidence to make a strong case about each teacher's performance. Close the high-stakes evidence gap. As you approach the end of the year, it's essential to review your evidence for each high-stakes evaluation and ensure that you have enough evidence to make a strong case about each teacher's performance. By the end of the year, many teachers you initially categorized as high stakes will have demonstrated their abilities to your satisfaction, so you can recategorize them as low stakes. For more marginal teachers, it may be unclear exactly how you should rate the teacher in your final evaluation, so it will take extra time, effort, and diligence to assemble your evidence and make your decisions. Long before any formal evaluation documents are due, start marking a copy of your school's formal evaluation tool with the evidence you have, so you can determine what evidence you lack. You may want to print a copy of your evaluation rubric for each teacher and write dates on each section to indicate when you've collected evidence relevant to that criterion. Then, as you conduct your remaining formal observations, you can ensure that you collect enough evidence and schedule additional observations as needed. You may find that your standard schedule of observations is adequate and that you can best devote your additional effort to mining these observations more deeply for evidence in multiple areas. If you've taken detailed, low-inference notes and develop a high degree of skill in linking them to your instructional framework, you'll have plenty to work with. It's fortunate that this extra investment of time and effort can take place entirely in writing without causing the teacher any undue alarm. Remember, you're only categorizing evaluations as high stakes in your own mind, so if the evidence reveals that a teacher is actually performing at a satisfactory level, you can avoid the stress and conflict inherent in pursuing a negative year-end evaluation. However, for the teachers who do seem to be marching quickly toward a negative evaluation, it's often wise to conduct several additional observations. By this stage, it will become obvious that the teacher is receiving more scrutiny, so it's appropriate to inform the teacher of your concerns and start outlining clear expectations for improvement in specific areas. Because you've limited the time you're spending on the other 80% of your evaluations, you'll have more time and mental energy for these challenging evaluations. While a full exploration of how to deal with challenging evaluations is beyond the scope of this book, the approach outlined should give you the two things you need most: time and evidence. Because you're spending so much time in classrooms on an informal basis, you can approach your low-stakes evaluations with a great deal of confidence, allowing you to complete the formal evaluation process very quickly. Because you'll start collecting written evidence during your third round of classroom visits, you'll have a sizable body of documentation about each teacher's practice, even if you don't conduct any additional formal observations. This approach allows you to allocate additional time to high-stakes evaluations as needed, and to further modify your approach as you learn more about each teacher's performance. An alternate means of differentiation is to use the CEIJ format with your high-stakes evaluations. Learn the Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, and Judgment format for writing rock-solid evaluations. When preparing a high-stakes negative evaluation, the Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, and Judgment format, SAFIR 1993, is invaluable. This time-tested approach was passed on to me when I was an administrator in Seattle Public Schools, and I've developed the following descriptions to help you craft clear, well-supported arguments about teachers' performance. You can use CEIJ to write extraordinarily strong, positive evaluations, for example, in recommendation letters, but for our purposes in this chapter, we'll focus on negative evaluations, because low-stakes evaluations generally don't justify the time required to write a thorough CEIJ format evaluation. The foundation of the CEIJ format is clarity. It requires that you eliminate all ambiguity from your writing. Rather than require readers to draw their own conclusions from the evidence you present, the CEIJ format walks the reader step by step through a straightforward and logical argument. The claim is an unambiguous statement about the teacher's overall practice in reference to a specific evaluation criterion. For example, a claim might be, Mrs. Smith does not deal effectively with student misconduct and has failed to establish a classroom climate conducive to learning. As a result, students spend significant time off task and engaged in conflict. You must back this claim, of course, with solid evidence, such as, for example, on 131, I observed a brief exchange in which two students exchanged verbal insults, followed by a 15-minute attempt on Mrs. Smith's part to get the students to ignore each other. During this time, instruction completely stopped, and the conflict was not resolved. In another incident that I observed on 217, three of the five groups spent their group work time arguing over who would do the work and completed less than half of the assignment in the designated time. The verbatim evidence, notes from the observation, should already be in the teacher's possession, so there's no room to dispute the facts. However, you may want to withhold an overall interpretation of this evidence from individual conversations throughout the year and only articulate it in the final evaluation, since you're evaluating the teacher's overall practice. For example, the interpretation might read, "Because Mrs. Smith does not deal with student misbehavior in a timely and authoritative fashion, the classroom environment makes it difficult for students to learn, even for students who are attempting to ignore distractions." While it may be premature to make such generalizations after a single observation, by the end of the year, the pattern should be clear enough to summarize in this way and then pass judgment on. Therefore, in Professional Practice Standard 4, Classroom Management, Mrs. Smith's practice is best characterized as Level 1, Unsatisfactory. While the CEIJ format includes a degree of redundancy, a few clarifications are in order. First, the claim is a statement about the teacher's characteristic practice, whereas the interpretation describes the impact of this practice on student learning or other relevant outcomes. Second, while the claim makes a summary statement about the teacher's practice, it's more descriptive in nature than the judgment, which is simply a rating based on the evaluation criteria. By separately articulating each of these aspects of the argument using the CEIJ format, you can craft a compelling argument that is virtually impossible to dispute, assuming you have the necessary evidence. If you find it difficult to start with a clear claim, it may help to go through several drafts, starting with your gut-level feeling about the teacher's practice. In fact, the process of writing a CEIJ argument can help you clarify whether your concerns about a teacher are rooted in substantial evidence of poor performance, based on limited evidence that requires further substantiation, or rooted mainly in personal annoyances that should not trigger a negative evaluation. You might start by articulating your most blunt, even unprofessional, feelings about the teacher's practice. For example, "Mrs. Smith's classroom is a disaster. She has no control, the kids are awful to each other, even though they're great kids outside of her class, and they can never focus on learning. She wastes the whole lesson dealing with conflicts that should have been prevented in the first place." Clearly, this type of statement can't appear in a formal evaluation. But if it reflects how you actually feel, it can be a useful starting point because it will allow you to examine your perceptions in light of the evidence you have on hand. The next step is to convert each statement into professional language that you can validate with evidence. For example, "Mrs. Smith's classroom is a disaster" might become, "Mrs. Smith has failed to establish a classroom climate conducive to learning." The claim, "She wastes the whole lesson dealing with conflicts that should have been prevented in the first place," could be restated as, "Mrs. Smith does not deal effectively with student misconduct," and "She has no control, the kids are awful to each other, and they can never focus on learning," could become, "As a result, students spend significant time off task and engaged in conflict." Each of these revised statements uses appropriate terminology, and you can demonstrate or refute them with evidence. If you find that you lack such evidence, you may want to conduct additional formal observations, and if you still don't have clear evidence to support the claim, you will need to revise your claim. For example, you may expect teachers to apply what they have learned in professional development, but if it's not in the evaluation criteria, it's unlikely to withstand scrutiny, and is therefore best to exclude from formal evaluations. Repeat the CEIJ writing process for each area in which the teacher's practice is unsatisfactory. You may find that negative ratings on just one or two criteria are required to trigger an overall negative evaluation and begin the process for probation or non-renewal. Check with your supervisor, legal counsel, and human resources department to establish clarity on the process in your school or district. High-stakes evaluations do not and should not result in dismissal every time. The CEIJ format can be helpful for any high-stakes evaluation, not just those that are a step toward dismissal. If you can connect related areas of underperformance, you can craft both a stronger argument and articulate a clearer path to improvement. For example, if you discern that a teacher's poor planning is contributing to his struggles with classroom management, clarifying this with CEIJ will help the teacher understand how to improve. If the teacher has tried to improve his classroom management using only rewards and consequences, seeing the connection between lesson planning and student behavior could be transformative. This combination of accountability and support increases the probability that other decision makers, such as school board members, will support your decision. In most cases, you'll want to resist the temptation to write an evaluation that is strongly negative in all areas. You should never issue such an evaluation unless the situation warrants it and you have adequate evidence for each criterion. Otherwise, the evaluation will appear to be based on personal animosity rather than reality. Often, teachers who are underperforming in one area are perfectly satisfactory in other areas. For example, a teacher with poor classroom management skills may have excellent relationships with colleagues. If you attempt to give low marks in areas in which the teacher is actually proficient, you will undermine the credibility of the entire evaluation, making it more likely to be overturned if appealed. To craft effective final evaluations, use the CEIJ format when appropriate, but don't overdo it. If a teacher is satisfactory in some areas, you can use the CEIJ format for consistency or provide more general statements indicating your lack of concern in those areas. Again, you may only need to document one or two unsatisfactory areas in order to take the action you feel will most benefit students. And by all means, if you discover as a result of the CEIJ writing process that your concerns are too limited in scope to justify an overall negative evaluation, consider using a coaching approach rather than the evaluation process to help the teacher make the necessary improvements. To learn more about John Safier's CEIJ approach, see his 1993 book, How to Make Supervision and Evaluation Really Work, Supervision and Evaluation in the Context of Strengthening School Culture. Day 17 Action Challenge. Identify high-stakes teachers. Make a confidential list of the 20% of teachers whose evaluations you currently view as high-stakes, teachers who are new, clearly struggling, or marginal. Keep this list to yourself and use it to guide your evidence collection and formal evaluations. Don't treat these teachers differently, but take extra care in compiling all of the evidence you'll need if corrective action becomes necessary. As you continue your classroom visits and converse with teachers, keep your focus on the evidence from the visit and strive to make clearer, more explicit references to your instructional framework. You may want to consider the following questions for reflection. Which teachers do I know the least about? How much time have I spent in their classrooms so far? When have I been surprised by a performance issue late in the school year? What warning signs did I miss? What caused me to overlook these warning signs? What indicators give me confidence that a teacher can safely be considered low stakes?